I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track Open Line. We're celebrating 20 years in business and just entering our seventh year of doing open line programs. It's very exciting because the numbers just keep growing and growing and growing over the years. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have a new 2015 open line format that comes with the launch of our brand new website. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication and event tab. Plus, our new book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon or by clicking on the book icon on our homepage. Our topic today is attracting, motivating, and retaining top performers. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Service. I'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into this very important topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement to bring effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including interpersonal coaching, executive onboarding for success, leadership training, operational productivity improvement, and exploring global options for expanding your business. In fact, we just opened an office in Taiwan, so if you have an operation in Asia and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas for how to interact with a U.S.-based company, please let us know. Our Keeping on Track Open Line series is a response to the feedback we get from those attending, both domestically and globally, so we address the business issues that we are all facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas in during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. We do have quite a large crowd today, so if we don't get to everybody, please understand you can talk to our guest offline. But we do want you to share your thoughts and insights along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guest. So during our time together, write down two or three questions to either send in during the program on our chat box or ask them once we open the line up. Our special guest with us today is Larry Comp. Larry is a longtime personal friend, business friend. Larry's in my CEO roundtable group and happens to be my accountability partner, so he makes sure I stay on track. He is just also an amazing person for what he gives back to the world. He just has a huge heart. He's affectionately known as the local, quote, comp guy, serves as managing principal for LTC Performance Strategies, Inc. Over the years, Larry and his team have helped close to 500 leading organizations across the country utilizing innovative total compensation solutions to attract, motivate, and retain quality performers. A prior leader with Nissan and Baxter Healthcare, Larry holds a master's in human resources management, has been recognized as a certified management consultant, and is a co-author of the recently released book, Executive Compensation for Private Company CEOs and Business Owners. I feel privileged to have Larry with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issue. Also, registration will begin at the end of this program for our next topic, which will be creating a legacy family business. Larry, welcome to Open Line.
Thanks, Danny, for your very kind words and for keeping me accountable. It's just fun to get to know you more and more. And congratulations on the office in Taiwan. I didn't know that. That's very exciting. So this morning, we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to be discussing 7 tips for attracting, motivating, and retaining top performers. And I like to refer to these tips as the lucky 7 because we find that the better companies get at leveraging these tips, the luckier they seem to become. So let's start off by looking at what keeps executives up at night. And when we ask boards and CEOs what's keeping them up at night, the most common response we get is losing our top performers. And, you know, we didn't get this response a few years ago when we were going through the terrible recession. And, of course, since then, the business climate's improved significantly. I know, Dana, we were just talking about that a few minutes ago. And the long-predicted skills gap that we've been hearing about for, it seems like, about 10 years has finally become a reality with more and more of the baby boomers retiring all the time. So next to the response of losing our top performers, probably the second most common response is attracting top performers. And I know, Dana, you and Ellen can relate to this as your organization plays a big role in helping companies to identify the right people for their organizations. So let's jump into the tips. First tip, demonstrate that our best people are our greatest asset. Think about what I just said. For years, we've all heard companies say that their people are their greatest what? Fill in the blank. It's they all say our people are our greatest asset. Sure, and we've been reading that statement in company annual reports for many years, but recently we've seen more and more companies kind of changing their tune here. Now instead of saying people are our greatest assets, a lot of them are saying it's their best people that are their greatest assets. So we have to ask ourselves, why the change? Well, research is now indicating that top performers often outperform their counterparts by as much as 2 to 10 times. And I think until recently it's been hard to get this kind of research. But when you think about that, you know, somebody outperforming, let's say, a typical performer by that degree, that's huge. And we need to do a better job of engaging and retaining these critical performers, especially in this era which we're continually asked to do more with less.
Oh, Larry, back to the other slide. We have a question that came in.
Oh, sure.
In what types of positions do you typically see the greatest differences in contributions between top and average performers?
Probably the first one that comes to mind is sales. I know some time back, well, many, many years ago, I got into sales, and I remember that I was doing better than most of the other folks in the sales team. And there was somebody else that was just smoking us. So he was making big money, never did figure out what he was doing, but that's the first thing, the first one that comes to mind is sales. Software engineer. You know, we find that a great software engineer can outproduce an average software engineer by many, many multiples. C-level performers, you know, CEOs, COOs, folks like that. It's harder, I guess the flip side of that, Dana, it's harder in the folks out there, it's harder to see that when you have, let's say, production workers that are all, you know, pretty much doing the same thing and are working to certain standards. But, yeah, mostly sales and C-level and software engineers come to mind. Okay. So let's move on to, with that in mind, tip two, pay for performance. And I know you've all been hearing about that for a long time. I'm not sure how many of you came across this one study that got kind of famous. Bain Consulting, one of the consulting think tanks, many, many years ago, conducted an intriguing study. What they did was they asked CEOs from around the country to think about all the initiatives they had tried over the years, which we kind of laughingly refer to as MMA, or Management by Magazine article, and to then select their number one initiative in terms of what had given them the greatest return on investment. And interestingly, it was pay for performance. I almost fell off my chair when I saw that. And then Bain conducted the same study several years later with the same result. Number one is pay for performance. I think number two was strategic planning. And then there was a host of other initiatives that we're all familiar with. So that was kind of striking. But when we're all talking about pay for performance, what does that really look like? So that takes us to tip 3A, don't bank on the bell curve. Now, a lot of us have seen in the news lately that a lot of organizations like Microsoft, and I think yesterday there was a news article about GE has 300,000 employees tossing out their performance appraisal programs. So that's one of the new trends that we're seeing. But most of us still use performance appraisals in our organizations. And whether we grade our employees on a 5-point scale, which is maybe the most popular methodology, or a 3-point scale or a 4-point scale, what we see is that most of the money that companies spent on employee salaries, on merit increases, and bonuses go to our typical employees, the ones that are rated pretty much in or around the middle, whether we call it meet expectations, effective, meet standards, or whatever. And in essence, what we're doing is we're following the bell curve, and that's what we've done, you know, for many, many decades. But there's a book that just came out, Work Rules. Some of you may have come across it by the head of people, human resources, or people operations, I forget his exact title, from Google. And he talks about the bell curve in the book, and he said the bell curve fails to accurately measure true human performance. In essence, it massively underpredicts the exceptional contribution of a relatively small number of performers in an organization. You might call that the Michael Jordan effect if you want to use a basketball analogy. I remember when I was with Baxter, we used a 5-point scale, and we call the top rating distinguished, and that's about 2% of the population, maybe somewhere between 2% and 5%. So then if you think about the reality of most organizations and organization life, if we're giving almost all of our people pretty much the same increases, who's most satisfied? Is it our top performers or average performers? And you have to say, think about it, you'd have to come up with, it's our average performers. It's the top performers that are probably most interested in pay for performance, and if we're not doing that effectively, they're typically going to be the first ones to leave us, which brings us to tip 3B.
Oh, Larry, a question just came in.
Okay.
Have you seen any examples of companies where a few performers have contributed the lion's share towards their success?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've seen a lot of that. You know, we've had a chance to work with about 500 organizations. Interestingly, Microsoft, I don't know whether it was Bill Gates or one of the other leaders, at one point said that it was really about a half a dozen people in Microsoft that accounted for most of their success, and that's a huge organization. So, you know, when we're talking about that top 2% or top 5%, we've seen that in many, many organizations, you know, where going back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, about outperforming, you know, let's say the standard performed by 2 times, by 5 times, 10 times, yeah, their performance is very significant. And the trick is really making sure that you recognize that performance. Appreciate the question. So if we go on to tip 3B, pay unfairly, now I can just imagine, you know, the HR folks and some of the rest of us on the phone cringing when I just said pay unfairly. And I, for one, completely understand that, having been, you know, corporate HR leader with companies like Baxter and Nissan, where at the time we all focused on being fair. We all focused on internal equity. So if you had a department of 30 employees, for instance, and let's say the average merit increase was 3%, which has been the average for the last several years, guess what almost everyone received? Yeah, about 3%. I remember sitting in my office going to, you know, reviewing all the department worksheets, and it was a 3% merit increase, you know, 3%, 3%, 3%, 3%, 3.5%, 3%, 3%, 2.5%. And sitting there thinking, are all these people performing at the same level? And that seemed ridiculous. But again, at the time, we were all very, very concerned about fairness and internal equity. And, you know, I'm not underestimating the difficulty of pay for performance, especially now that merit increases have fallen over the years from 8% down to 4% for about a 10-year period, down to 3%, and are actually predicted to fall to 2%. With bonus payouts shrinking, even with business turning around, we've noticed that bonus payouts are actually at a lower level, and we think that's mostly because there's more stretch in the goals. And stock grants are way down. A lot of companies have totally gotten away from vehicles like stock options. So I don't want to underestimate the challenge of doing that, but I think we need to think more about this concept of paying fairly or paying unfairly. What does that really mean? So what do we mean by fair and unfair pay? It seems that most of us have thought that paying fairly meant paying everyone in the same role about the same amount of money, just like we were talking about a few minutes ago. But we're finding that the most forward-thinking companies are now taking pay for performance much more seriously and focusing on paying for real contribution. For instance, during this time of 3% average merit increases, we're finding some companies are quietly, I want to emphasize quietly, pulling some of their top performers aside and giving them maybe as much as 15% increases. And so, again, even with the constraint of the 3% increases, you know, a lot of companies have slush funds, and they're doing what they have to do to keep their best people.
Larry, go back. We got three questions.
Okay.
I'm going to do them in order of what they how they came in. First question is, what are some examples of how forward-thinking organizations are paying top performers for their exceptional contributions?
That's a great question. Yeah, the first thing is with merit increases. Again, we've been seeing 3% increases for quite a while, but we are seeing many companies, more and more companies all the time, you know, giving much higher than average increases, like I said, about 15% increases. Some are giving lump sum bonuses. A lot of the folks, you know, in the audience are familiar with that, where it might be an out-of-cycle, you know, piece of recognition where the supervisor just meets with his or her employee and says, you know, I just want to tell you, you did a great job here. Here's a token of our appreciation. They give somebody some money. We're seeing with bonus programs, you know, when we say short-term incentive programs, those are programs that are for performance no more than a year. We're seeing in sales compensation and bonus programs where folks are experiencing higher leverage. So, for instance, if somebody has a, let's say you have a group of managers and they all have a 10% target bonus, you know, if the company meets its goals and the individual meets their goals, most of those folks might get 10%. But we're seeing higher leverage where you might find, let's say, one or two people with a 10% target bonus get as much as 150%. It's, let's say, 15,000 or 15% or 200%, 20%. So we're seeing in the area of bonuses. We're seeing it in terms of long-term compensation, you know, maybe more equity or being included in an equity or cash long-term incentive plan. We've seen long-term incentive compensation run the whole gamut from, again, Dana, when you and I were growing up in the world, you know, it was very unusual to get any kind of stock options or long-term compensation. Then all of a sudden what happened? We went to the dot-com era, which interestingly was followed shortly thereafter with the dot-gone era, and it became kind of faddish for people to get stock options, and you'd see these universal programs where almost everybody was getting some level stock. Well, companies have started to rethink that, and more of them are cutting down the eligibility there and restricting long-term compensation grants, whether it's equity or non-equity grants, to who they consider to be their strategic players. And so you might have somebody who isn't an executive but is seen as a very strong individual contributor that will be invited to participate in one of these plans, or they get included in, let's say, a hot skills program. This could be a certain kind of programmer. Or invited to become part of a non-qualified deferred compensation plan, which has typically been restricted to top executives. So when we first started talking about pay for performance, it really was more in the base salary, but now we're seeing pay for performance creep into almost all forms, short term, long term, and even executive benefits like long term, like deferred compensation.
Thank you, Larry. Two more questions. Second one is, in a team-based environment, what would be the motivation for a top-performing individual to share their best practice techniques with the team if there is pay-for-performance incentive programs?
That's a tough question. So you have team-based pay, or you have people working in teams, it seems like, right? When you look at most incentive plans, I think the important thing to realize is that you want to incent people to work towards the organizational goals first, and then focus on how they can make a difference. And even with these team-based teams where you have people focused in teams, they may first be tied to how well the overall organization works together. So in my opinion, when you have a situation like that and you have some members of the team that have some very worthwhile things to share, it would behoove them to share, because if they can help improve their own performance and then help bring up everybody else's performance, not only does the company better survive, but maybe thrive. And that might even mean precluding layoffs that could be pending. You know what I mean? So I think it's always a good idea, if people can share what they learn and really work more collaboratively versus it's horrible when you have too much of a focus on internal competition, one person against the other.
Okay. Thank you. Last question. Number of the large companies are offering extended paternity leave that's in the news. How do mid-cap companies compete with that?
Well, I'm not so sure. It's not something that I've personally studied a lot, but I'm not of the opinion that those practices are restricted to only publicly traded companies. I mean, we are finding small companies and mid-sized companies that are really trying to address this whole work-life balance thing that we've been talking about for about 20 years. So my thought on that would be, if you're really concerned about attracting and retaining your best and your most suitable performers, then that's something that would be important to take a look at. And I don't think it is restricted to the largest organizations only, and I certainly don't think it should be.
And you guys could always talk offline about that, how to structure that so it's cost-effective, et cetera. But great questions. Thank you. Keep feeding them in. Yeah. I'm going to go to the next slide, Larry.
You guys are really stretching me. Thank you. Okay. There's a lot of meat to this slide, getting the biggest bang for our buck. While most organizations agonize over merit increases, I mean, are we going to give 3% or 3.25 or 3.5%? Or equity grants, when you think about a company's biggest expense, it's typically compensation. And when you think about the different vehicles, base salary, short-term incentive pay, long-term incentive pay, research has shown that properly developed and communicated short-term incentive or bonus programs are a company's most potent tool for driving the desired performance and behavior. And I want to point that out, because what you really want to do is, just like appraisals, you don't want to wait till the end of the year to give somebody feedback. The same thing with bonuses. You don't want to have a discretionary bonus where you wait till the end of the year and then you give somebody their turkey or their $100 or $1,000 or whatever, and they can't connect the dots. You want to structure those bonuses so that people know what they need to do to help their companies and therefore help themselves throughout the year, and you want them thinking about that. It's interesting that you know, we talked about universal stock programs becoming popular. Well, it seemed like about 20 years ago, companies were really trying to find a way to motivate people, and they all jumped on this bonus bandwagon. Unfortunately, most companies threw their plans together and didn't get very good results. And even the ones that spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about the methodology and trying to get the methodology right, oftentimes did a very bad job of communicating these plans. And so where we stand today in 2015 is most of these companies that have bonus programs, and just about all of them have them, in fact, even most of the nonprofits we work with have them, most of them have failed to achieve their intended objectives with these plans. So I'm going to share a few considerations for the folks on the call in terms of how they might consider making these programs more effective. And the first one is called goal sharing. And that's not a term even today that a lot of people know about. But it's one of those things that in some ways turned my life around in terms of a pay-for-performance or, you know, compensation consultant. I was sitting in my office, you know, back in the 1990s, you know, catching up on my reading, and, you know, like all you guys, you know, you feel like you're reading a lot of the same stuff over and over again, but I came across this article about Corning, which is a huge organization, and they had brought a consultant in, and that consultant had helped them put together something called goal sharing, which was just simply a goal-based program that had some good alignment where everybody knew what they needed to do to help make a contribution. And they created this in the 1990s. And I'll share a couple statistics that came out of those early years. The first year they did it, cycle time dropped 20% in 1 year. And that's amazing. And then over the next years, productivity doubled over 7 years. The number of defects, they were really having a problem with quality, and they focused their efforts and their goal sharing to a certain extent on quality, and they found that their defects decreased by 10 times, and then subsequent to that, their product returns decreased 24 times. This is an organization that wasn't doing terribly bad, but they could stand to improve, and they did these things, and they went on to actually win the Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award, which a lot of us were being trained to compete for many, many years ago. So what we were amazed at what we were reading about goal sharing, and we decided to focus on that and try to do it even better than Corning was doing, and that's a big part of what we do is we help companies with company-wide incentive programs. But I think probably even beyond those statistics, to me what's most impressive is they've stuck with this. You know, I was teasing a couple minutes ago about MMA, Management by Magazine article, but honest to goodness, I mean, companies go from one thing to the next. They try something, it doesn't tend to work. But Corning has started this program in the 90s, and they still do it. And last time I looked, about 15,000 of their employees had gone through it. So it's very solid. It's withstood the test of time. To take it up even a higher level, let's look at this concept of building a company of business people. Some of you may have heard the concept of business literacy, which was pretty hot some time ago. And we came across this, I think back in the 90s also, we were studying a company called Springfield Remanufacturing Company out of Springfield, Missouri, close to St. Louis. And they had one of the most depressing cultures. It was almost like the old Vega plant, Chevy Vega plant in Lordstown, Ohio. You know, one of the most depressing, dysfunctional organizations we'd ever seen. And to make a long story short, the company was about ready to go under. And then their top executive, a guy named Jack Stack, who's a client of ours and we're a client of his, came out and made a deal with the employees that he would teach them the business, teach them about business and specifically their business. And if they could keep from going under and turn things around, he'd take the plant manager's bonus and split it with them. And not only did the company survive, but it went on to become one of the most successful companies in the United States. We looked at their early stock value when they were having trouble, and it was 19 cents a share. And last time I looked, it was over $80 a share. Now, I'm not talking about 19 cents to 80 cents. I'm talking about 19 cents to $80. Doesn't all resemble our personal financial portfolio? Wish it did. But it was just amazing what they'd gone through. And they went on to spin off many other companies, and some of you may have seen Jack Stack on the front cover with President Bush many years ago. Remarkable. That's a very powerful technique, is teaching people to understand the business, because after all, we ask them to set goals. Well, if they don't understand the business, it's very hard for them to set goals, which then moves us to the third thing I want to share with you, and that is moving from an activity orientation to goal-based orientation. You know, nowadays, you go up to somebody and ask them how they're doing, what's the most common response? Yeah, most common response is busy. Everybody's so busy, and that's what we find in organizations. A lot of times we'll walk in and ask the leaders, does your organization look more like eagles flying in formation? And we know eagles don't fly in formation. Or does it look more like seagulls crashing into one another? And they'll nervously laugh and say, seagulls crashing into one another. And so we try to help them think about alignment and getting people away from this activity orientation, which gives people kind of a rush, but it's not that effective in trying to get everybody organized and going in the same direction. And so we've been asked by a lot of organizations to teach people how to write performance goals, and that's nothing new. A lot of you are sitting there thinking, yeah, I know the SMART goal. I know how to write them, specific, measurable, action-oriented, realistic, and time-sensitive. That's efficiency. And a lot of us know how to do that. A lot of us teach our employees how to do that. But what we came up with a couple years back was a realization that it's not so much teaching people how to articulate their goals. It's how to pick the right goals in the first place. And we surprisingly found that a lot of the C-level folks that we were working with, they were very good at critiquing things, but they were not very good at coming up with the right goals. And you know, if you don't come up with the right goals at the top of the organization, how are you going to expect optimal results when you're trying to line the goals and layer them throughout the organization? One of your clients, Dana, recently asked us to come in and teach their employees, again, not only how to articulate, but how to select the goals. They've been working with one of our other dear friends on strategic planning for the last several years, and that's taken them a good way, but then they have some problem with execution. So you can have the goals, you can come up with a great strategic plan and have the goals pretty well aligned at the top, but if you don't know how to really get people focused and moving forward and picking the right goals and aligning them correctly, then you're not going to have the right results. And so we recently taught all 70 employees how to pick and articulate the goals. And the feedback, we asked the CEO and COO to just give us a quick, on a five-point scale, we asked them 10 different things, and they said fives on all of them. Pertaining mostly to engagement alignment, and we asked them what they're seeing in terms of results, and they said they're expecting exceptional results. And what's interesting, when our clients ask us about these programs like goal sharing, and they're asking us, you know, well, what should we expect? And we usually say, well, you know, you should get good results the first year, very good results the second year, and third year you ought to be flying. And some of them come back after 3 months and say, hey, we're just tearing it up. And we just kind of laugh because we'd rather kind of under-promise and over-deliver on that. And we find it's almost like that saying from that book. You know, a lot of us, our favorite book back I guess in the 70s or 80s was Jonathan Livingston Seagull. And there's this one part where this Jonathan asked the wise goal, question, and the wise goal looks at him and says, it always works when you know what you're doing. I've never forgotten that, and we try to remember that when we're working with organizations, that performance appraisals aren't bad, bonus programs aren't bad. They can work, and they work for a lot of us as long as we know what we're doing.
Now, one of the things that I know at Kravitz, they had their annual meeting, and when the CEO announced that they were no longer going to do annual reviews, they were going to do quarterly reviews,
right.
there was a stand-up ovation, and everyone was cheering so loud it was deafening, I was told.
Right. Yeah, well, we happen to get exposure to all of that, and Dan's become a great client for us also, and a dear friend. And, they're one of those organizations that set out to, develop the perfect appraisal program, and it became very cumbersome, took a tremendous amount of time, and was very frustrating. And so I don't want the people on the phone to think that they're not still evaluating people, but they've come up with a much easier way to do that, and they're giving regular feedback. And that was part of the problem, is if you don't have a really good process and then you wait till the quote annual event, which sometimes is 18 months later instead of 12, you get a lot of frustrated managers and employees. But they're migrating to what a lot of other organizations are doing right now, and that is finding more frequent touch points to be able to ideally have conversations at least once a month, but certainly no less than once a quarter. And we're so excited. We're so excited for them, and they're so excited because that's an example. We were talking a few minutes ago about publicly traded organizations. Some of our clients that have 20 employees, 50 employees, 70 employees are way more advanced. They're very much on the leading edge compared to, surprisingly, a lot of the publicly traded companies that we work with. So I think size is sometimes, when it pertains to this, is you got to look a little bit beyond that.
Well, thanks, Larry. That's a great topic.
Great question.
Let's go to the next slide.
All right, let's do that.
Perfect.
All right, so tip number 5, help your employees meet their financial needs. The reality is almost all of us worry about money, our financial futures. And what surprised me when I came across this was senior executives are no different. I guess growing up in the corporate world, you think, if you're the CEO, you must be the smartest one there and be kind of next to God in a way. But we're finding from our research that senior executives are no different than the rest of us in terms of understanding personal finance. A lot of them have the same challenges, maybe even more challenges than their non-executive counterparts. Yet, what's important is money is constantly on their minds and often adversely affects their focus and productivity. A lot of times they're calling their brokers, they're sitting there worrying about things, and I think companies are waking up and realizing, let's deal with reality. We know we got to have our people do more with less, but a lot of the progressive companies out there are taking proactive steps to help their executives and their other employees to better understand what their financial requirements are going to be. With that Time Magazine article that came out a couple months ago, it showed this baby saying that baby might live to 140. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know with a lot of us if we want to live that long, but we're realizing that we are living longer, and we're going to need more money. So companies are becoming more proactive to help these folks learn how to close any gaps they might have. This may manifest itself in individual counseling or group financial counseling. And by the way, some of these kinds of benefits are very inexpensive. Now there are Cadillac programs out there that cost an awful lot of money, but there are low group individual and group financialing benefits out there. Some of them go to great efforts to explain how participants can get the most out of their 401k plans or their cash balance plans. Again, they might have really good plans, but a lot of companies are just terrible in terms of helping people understand how to leverage these plans. And again, what they're really going to need down the road and how to kind of get there. Some are offering concierge programs. That's something that I think most of the folks online probably are not aware of. When I'm talking about executives. There's concierge programs been around a long time, but because executives a lot of times find a gap maybe in terms of just the money that they have versus what they're going to need, or they find that they don't have enough disability insurance, and if something happens, they become disabled, that could be catastrophic for them. So they're setting up these concierge programs to help people, to help personalize a little bit more to the individual, so that individual, instead of worrying about this all the time, realizes, has a better understanding of where he or she is and what they need to do to take proactive steps to get where they need to go. Non-qualified deferred comp plans, those have been around. They predate qualified or 401k plans by about 30 or 40 years, but many of us that are not with publicly traded companies or the larger companies don't even know, you know, that they exist. Non-qualified deferred compensation plans, we are asked, you know, how would you define them? And we laughingly describe them sometimes as 401ks and steroids, because with a 401k plan, I think employees can now defer, I think it's $18,000 this year, and if you're 50 years old or over, there's a catch-up provision. And if you're making $50,000 a year, $60,000 a year or so, you can replace a lot of that income. But if you're making $200,000 or $500,000 or $1 million or $2 million a year, and all you can defer is $18,000 or $25,000, in essence, you're being discriminated against as a highly paid employee. I know that sounds funny, but that is the way it goes. And so we're finding now a lot of these mid-sized companies, they want the same thing a lot of the big guys have, and so they're putting in different versions of non-qualified deferred compensation plans. So there's a lot of things that are being done. So let's move on to the next tip. Help your team to grow or die. Grow or die. You know, we've heard this for a long time, especially for, you know, organizations that are entrepreneurs. We know if we're not growing, if we're not moving forward, we're in essence moving backwards. But we don't often take the time to think about, all right, well, how does this apply to our employees? It's not just our company. But, you know, if we're growing but we're not helping them to grow, then things might break down with them. Or a lot of us are noticing that more and more of the employees coming into the workforce are millennials, and that millennials will make up about 50% of our workforce by 2020. And what do they want? They want everything, and they want it right now, and probably those of us that are parents, you know, have to shoulder some of the blame for that. But they'll work for knowledge, and it's very important for them to feel like they're continuing to grow. A lot of them have a different time horizon. My first company, Fortune, you know, 100 company, I thought I'd be there 40 years. Didn't work out that way. It hasn't worked out that way for most of us out there. The typical millennial that you talk to, I think, is thinking they'll maybe stay about 3 years. They could stay longer, but it involves getting inside their heads collectively and finding a way to help them grow. You know, for instance, you know, we talked a little bit about performance appraisal. We won't get off on that tangent, but a lot of organizations now are throwing performance appraisals out the window at a time when pay for performance is getting hotter and hotter, and I'm questioning the wisdom of just doing that. And so I think what we're going to be seeing in the next couple months, next couple years, some much more progressive approaches to performance appraisal and feedback, and make it more of an ongoing type of thing.
Larry, a question just came in. Most organizations lack confidence in their current performance appraisal systems. In your mind, what would be some of the characteristics of a more effective and engaging approach to performance and career development?
Yeah, good question. First of all, explain why you're doing it in the first place. It's interesting that organization is kind of like, this is the way we've always done it. So it's that time of year. So here's your performance appraisal, and they've never taken the time to explain what the purpose is or what the benefit is for the company and the individual. A lot of them don't have very good performance measurements, so they rate people on maybe a whole bunch of criteria on a 5-point scale. Did you show up? Did you have a happy face? Those kinds of things. And that's really a turnoff for employees. So I think that the more progressive approaches that we've seen and that we're involved in, because we do a lot of work in this area, is to very simply define the what and the how of performance. And the what of performance a lot of times manifests itself as goals, you know, realistic stretch goals. And the how is also important. You know, you need to look at how the performer carries out his or her responsibilities. And we've all heard stories about the super salesperson, for instance, that leaves blood on the road. Well, that person is meeting the what, getting his or her job done, reaching the financial goals for the organization. But if that person is breaking down teamwork or harassing people or whatever, that's not going to fit. So I think it's finding the right balance between the what and how, giving feedback more frequently, asking for feedback, tying professional development into the process so people can connect the dots, and having good training the managers. You know, a lot of times now managers are not getting the kind of training that they got decades ago, and all of a sudden you're a manager now, you need to conduct an appraisal, and they don't have very good skills with coaching and feedback. So training for the managers, as well as I know when I was with the companies I was working with, we also taught the employees how what to expect from the appraisal process and what they needed to do to prepare for that process. Does that kind of get at what you're getting at, you think, Dana?
No, that's perfect. Remember, we have a couple more questions, but I'd like everybody to hold them for now, and so we can Larry can finish up, and a couple more slides, then we'll open up the line. You can ask directly.
I don't want to overabuse my time schedule here, so we're doing okay?
Yeah, no, we're doing good.
Okay. All right, just a couple more slides. Tip 7, over-communicate. You know, communicate. Research shows that employees are less trusting than years gone by. You know, they're not sticking around for the gold watch. You know, while many of us are offering them very attractive total rewards programs, they're not connecting the dots. I was with a C-level group yesterday, and we shared with them one of our findings is that even top executives, a lot of them don't understand how their programs work. It's amazing, you know. They're offered a short-term incentive program. They're offered stock options or performance-based shares or cash-based LTIP or stock appreciation rights or whatever it is, and they take it, but they don't understand it. And these are incentive programs, and the root of that word is to incent or to motivate. And, you know, so we have to start asking ourselves, you know, if people don't understand the value of these programs, how do we expect these programs to motivate them? So we're starting to see a lot of organizations focus more and more attention on communicating these programs, and we're being asked to come in and roll some of these programs out and answer questions. So, you know, to help the employees, to help the participants really understand what they have and how to benefit the company and themselves, you know, under these programs. And so, wrapping it up, well, that was a lot of stuff that we covered, and I appreciate the questions and the forthcoming questions. I think the main thing here is to realize that, you know, while we've always said that employees are our greatest asset, it's the focus really has shifted to our best employees. Now, that doesn't mean that we ignore the other folks, but, you know, we're finding more and more organizations saying, boy, if Sue leaves or Joe leaves, it's really going to hurt us. So we've got to reassess. We've got to focus on keeping our best employees. We've got to reassess what paying fairly really means. You know, we thought maybe we were paying fairly when we were paying everybody about the same, but you have to ask yourself, what does paying fairly really mean nowadays? And we've got to also help our employees to grow and to understand and appreciate what they have in terms of their total rewards program. It's not us against the employees. Sometimes it feels that way. I mean, after all, you know, we're really on the same side, or we should be, right? So, Dana, I really appreciate the opportunity to be with all of you today, and look forward to, you know, any other questions anybody has.
Well, I appreciate everyone attending. We're going to – everyone hold the line. I'm going to turn the recording feature off in just a second because we've been asked by those over the years that when they're asking questions during the open mic time, they didn't want their voices recorded, so we want to be very respectful of that. But first, before we do that, I want to thank Larry very much for taking the time today to share some very valuable ideas. You'll see on your screen, on the last slide here, our next program will be on September 22nd, Creating a Legacy Family Business. So sign up today. Tell your friends, association members, if they'd like to attend. And again, Larry, I want to thank you for being on Open Line, everybody for attending today. If everyone would please hold the line for 1 second. And one other thing before I turn the recording feature off. Once we open the lineup, if everyone could put your phones on mute, and then don't forget to unmute your phone when you have a question. Okay, so we'll be back in just about 30 seconds.